Our guest today is Professor David Linden. He is a neuroscientist at Johns Hopkins. So welcome to Things I Didn't Learn in School.
Thanks for having me.
You're also a prolific author who has helped open up your field to people like me and probably many of our listeners who are very curious but don't have the training experience you have. I want to spend most of the time on your most recent book, Unique, which I did find fascinating, and I read it and then reread sections of it, trying to digest it, so there's lots to talk about. But before we jump in there, you know, the thing that I think probably most people have heard of you have read recently is your article, your story in The Atlantic. And I don't really feel like we can begin talking until we talk about that. So Why don't you share sort of your background, but also what's going on with you right now for those people who haven't read the article?
Sure. Well, so this article in The Atlantic was something that I wrote as a consequence of my diagnosis several months ago with terminal cancer. A cancer called synovial sarcoma. And I went in for a routine echocardiogram, and they said, oh my gosh, what's that big mass poking up next to your heart? And remarkably, I felt fine. You know, that we would think that with something the size of a Coke can pressing against your heart, you would have some symptoms, but I didn't. You know, I could exercise at full capacity. But they said, yeah, this thing's got to have to come out. You're going to have heart surgery. So I went in and had heart surgery. And then they biopsied it. And what they found out was, as I mentioned, that it's this reasonably rare cancer called synovial sarcoma. So what this means, according to my oncologist, is that I have 6 to 18 months to live. And so my article in The Atlantic was really about, well, so what has this made me think about brain functioning? Because, you know, I'm a geek and I can't stop being curious.
It's what you've dedicated your career to and also your sort of public persona to as well. So you're sort of, you're a highly insightful person who has made a whole history of studying the mind, the biology, and also the tricks the mind can play on us. In a way, you're like the most qualified person I've ever run across to sort of examine this right in the middle of this. It's kind of unbelievable.
Well, you know, it's kind of a coping strategy a little bit, right? Because, you know, it's traumatic to learn that you have 6 to 18 months to live.
Terrifying.
And, you know, you feel like you're not really in the driver's seat anymore. And so one way to have a sense of control, to have a sense of agency, is to not stop being curious and to be introspective and to say, well, what does this reveal to me about what I care about most, which is human mental function? And there were really two main things that occurred to me. One of them is that really reinforces this idea that's become, I think, really dominant in neuroscience, which is that the brain is not built to give us the lowdown about the external world. In other words, there's no way to have pure sensory information, to have the unvarnished truth about the world come to you, because you are hardwired to take that raw information and manipulate it and spin it by your emotional state, by expectations, by your prior experience. So one way to think about this, we've all had the experience of being bored for a half an hour waiting in line at the Department of Motor Vehicles, and you think, oh God, when is this ever going to end? But the same amount of time, if you're having a conversation, you know, over beer or coffee with a friend, just flies by. Oh my gosh, that half an hour happened in a second, and I could.
There's no objective truth. Time is the classic example of it.
Time is the classic example of it, but you know, it comes up in many ways. One of the examples I like to use comes from the sense of touch, which I wrote one of my books about. And that is, you know, imagine you're in a loving, connected time with your sweetheart, and they give you a caress on the arm. You go, oh, that's nice. And then imagine the very same caress on your arm, very same from the same person, same place on your arm, the same pressure, the same dynamics. But instead, it's in the middle of an unresolved argument Well, it doesn't feel the same way at all. It doesn't feel good. It feels like a bug. You're like, hey, what are you doing? No, we're in the middle of this argument. Get your hands off of me. And it's not like, well, the pure sensory experience first feels the same, but then only later on reflection do you feel different about it. It feels different from the very first moment that you are having that sensation. And so this is brought home to me in the context of my own demise, because if I do a thought experiment and I imagine someone before my diagnosis coming to me and saying, oh, you've got 5 years to live, I would have been, oh, no, I'm, you know, 60 years old. So I'm hoping to have, you know, without this diagnosis, I'd be hoping to have quite a bit more than 5 years to live. I would say, oh, no, that's terrible. What do you mean? I feel so cheated. This is unfair. Now, with my present diagnosis, if someone said, you got 5 years to live, I'd be like, yeehaw, that's great. I can get a lot done in 5 years. So something as fundamental as 5 years of life that you would think would be, you know, one of these bedrock things that we would have a certain perception and feeling about are themselves malleable based upon circumstance, based upon expectation.
You'd said in one of your book, in one of your talks, not unique, I want to get there, but you said the brain is a mess. And in addition to the no objective experience, you also talked in your Atlantic article about contradictory states of mind.
Yeah, that's right. I did. And you know, in classically in neuroscience, we tend to think about, oh, the brain is in a particular state. You know, you're scared, you're hungry, you're exploratory, you're resting and digesting. No, not you're fleeing or you're fighting. But in truth, you know, our brains are complicated, and we can inhabit more than one mental state at a time, even if these mental states are contradictory. And I think most people thinking about it realize this. You know, I'm just a little thick, and it took this experience of my illness to bring it home, that I was feeling simultaneously, you know, white hot furious with the universe for getting heart cancer. I mean, heart cancer? Nobody gets heart cancer. When was the last time you heard about someone with heart cancer? Well, I've got bloody heart cancer, right? Mm. I'm going to die of it soon. And that stinks. But at the same time, feeling deeply grateful because I've had a wonderful life with wonderful people around me and great opportunities and the experience to do lots of things and lots of privilege and lots of wonderful experiences. So I can feel simultaneously angry and grateful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I think this is something that if you look in a lot of religious teachings, both Christian ones and Jewish ones and Buddhist ones, actually, this is not a new idea.
Right. You know? And I would say in terms of literature, my mind immediately goes to Proust. I mean, that's what he was describing. It took five volumes to do it, but it's all about contradictory states of mind.
It is.
That you're eating something and then all of a sudden your mind jumps somewhere else, and that sort of associative nature of the way we go through life.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Money is all around us, and we think about it more than almost every other aspect of our lives. But how can we make more of it, and what's our drive for building wealth beyond just the numbers in our bank account? Join us on the Make More podcast as our host Matt Heslin brings to you a dynamic lineup of experts in the world of investing, business, health, and beyond. Together, they unpack the secrets to not just surviving, but thriving in today's economy. It's about more than just wealth. It's about crafting life experiences, seizing opportunities, and building a legacy. Subscribe now to the Make More with Matt Heslin podcast and join us every week for new expert insights and inspiration.
Very, very good. Yes, good example. But I think the most important thing, the most important realization I had as a result of my diagnosis about mental function really has to do with prediction.
Okay.
And I'm old, and I've been a neuroscientist for a long time, over 40 years. And when I joined the field, the basic model of the brain is that it sits there waiting for something to happen.
Mm.
You're sitting there, la da 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 da. Oh, I see something with my eyes, or I taste something with my tongue, or I feel something with my skin. And those messages come into the brain, and then your brain does some computations. Maybe you make a decision, and then you do some action. You know, you move your muscles, you move your muscles to make speech, you know, and behavior comes out. But in this model, the brain is fundamentally a reactive thing. And we now know from many different kinds of experiments, including brain imaging in humans and also brain recording in critters, that that's not the way it works. The brain isn't just sitting there waiting. The brain is actively a prediction machine. While you're sitting there, the brain is expending a lot of energy trying to figure out what's going to happen in the next few moments. Is that person walking at me towards me down the street friend or foe? Am I likely to become hungry soon? And how should I plan my day as a result, right? The brain is always doing these predictions. And the fact that the brain is trying to predict and really trying to predict not so much about the far future, but about the immediate future, this all presupposes that there will be an immediate future.
Right.
And of course, when you're dead, there is no immediate future. It's
just done.
And so in this way, I think our brains are hardwired to not truly engage with our own demise and with the idea of a world without us in it. And so, you know, in my own case, right, I know I'm going to die soon. And so I can do practical stuff. You know, I make sure my will is in order and my finances. I can write recommendation letters to the people in my lab so they'll be there when I'm gone so that, you know, they have them for the next phase of their career. All this practical stuff I can do. But when I really try to engage with my own demise, I think, you know, my mind skates over the glossy surface of it. I don't think it's possible to engage deeply. And I don't think this is a personal failing. I think it is something basic and human.
It seems bizarre to me that I'm even pushing back on anything that you say. I mean, I feel like it's sort of let you talk and then hang up and let you use these this so precious time. In your book, though, Unique, is it part of the message of the book how varied our range of responses is? And how unique it could be.
Yeah. So
in other words, somebody else could disengage or fall into a deep depression. And it seems like your response is sharing what you're going through, almost like you yourself become another piece of data in your quest, your curiosity.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's certainly true. And, you know, we all become unique through developmental happenstance and experience in the world and what we inherit from our parents. And we'll get to that. What I would say is that much in the same way that every single baby in the world is born with being aversive to bitter taste, right? If you give them a bitter taste in their mouth when they're born, before they have accumulated any experience in the world, they'll all make the yuck face all over the world. Doesn't matter how your parents raise you, what culture you're in, whether you're in a cold place, a hot place, the tropics, the Arctic, it doesn't matter. All babies will do that. It's a human hardwired universal. I would contend that our human inability to truly engage with our own demise is similarly hardwired. That while one's strategies for dealing with it can be unique across individuals, that there is a basal level of it that comes with being human. And what I would say is that this is important not just on an individual level, but on a societal level. And what I mean by that is if you look, if you ask cultural anthropologists who, you know, look at cultures all over the world, and they would say, and you say, well, how many cultures in their thought have the idea of an afterlife or reincarnation or an idea that you fuse with the divine after you die? And cultural anthropologists will say, well, not absolutely everywhere, but almost absolutely everywhere do you have it. Almost all of the world's major religions, not all, but almost all do. And almost everywhere do you have these kinds of ideas. It's not quite a universal, but it's close to a universal cross-culturally. And so what I would say is that the prevalence of these afterlife reincarnation stories all around the world ultimately flows from human predictive thought. In other words, it ultimately flows from the fact that we're always trying to predict the near future, presupposing a near future, which then makes it very difficult for us to truly engage with our own demise, that is a sharp ending. And so as a consequence, we humans have developed these afterlife, reincarnation, fusion with the divine stories. And when we think about, you know, how these stories and how faiths have molded human history and the conflicts between faiths have molded human history, mm-hmm. you know, I think this is something that turns out to be pretty important in the way the human experience has been over the years.
In what way? What do you take away from that commonality?
Well,
that it's sort of been essential to the existence, the continuation of the tribe, that belief?
Well, you know, I think so much human conflict has been interreligious human conflict.
Yes.
Even faiths where you would say, well, you're getting down to some pretty subtle differences, Catholics versus Protestants. Well, there's big wars right. about that. Sunni versus Shia Muslims, right?
Right.
This flavor of Buddhist versus that flavor of Buddhist. All these times there have been conflicts and wars and people have died and borders have moved and nations have been formed.
But you're saying that the essential belief is the core.
You know, as a result of these conflicts of faith. And these faiths ultimately uh-huh. derive from afterlife stories.
Yeah.
And these afterlife stories ultimately derive, I think, from this bug in the brain
right.
that comes from us wanting to be prediction machines all the time.
Let's jump to your book, Unique. So there is, you've written a number of books. This is your most recent one. There is a lot in this book. But let me try to just say what I took away as the summary, and you tell me whether I got it right, and then we can maybe dig into where I'm wrong or dig into these things. So the key sentence to me in the book was, in terms of what leads us to be like we are, you had this statement, hereditary, interacting with experience, filtered through the inherent randomness of development. And in your book, this relates to height and weight, but also sexual preference, smell, sleep, intelligence. So that mixture of the hereditary, the experience, and the randomness coming together, having these fundamental drivers. So if you're looking at the explanations for any of those things, and probably the most controversial and really fascinating, I would love to talk about is towards the end of your book about intelligence, you have to look at it through that prism. Is that what you were trying to convey?
It is. And I think specifically when I make that statement about individual traits come about from heredity interacting with experience broadly defined, filtered through the inherent random nature of development, what I'm doing is I'm contrasting that with the popular phrase nature versus nurture,
right,
which is often used as a similar explanation. But I have two problems with nature versus nurture. So first of all, yeah, you got it right, basically. I think you zeroed in on the key point.
It only took me reading it twice, but thank you.
Well, if I'd written it better, you would have gotten it the first time. So that's on me. First of all, I have a problem with versus. The idea that your experience and what you inherit are somehow in competition with each other, because it's not true at all. In other words, these things interact. Sometimes they even reinforce each other. For example, if you are fortunate enough to be born with innate athletic ability and you're good at sports, then you're more likely to play sports and practice sports and get even better at sports through your experience of playing and practicing. So this isn't nature versus experience. This isn't heredity versus experience. This is heredity and experience summing together and interacting. A good example of this is the genetic disease called phenylketonuria, which in order to get it, you have to inherit from both your parents a broken version of a gene that encodes an enzyme that breaks down the amino acid, mm-hmm. phenylalanine. And so if you inherit this, that's one thing. But in order to actually get the disease, you have to eat foods that are rich in phenylalanine. If you have a diet that doesn't have much phenylalanine in it, you'll never have the disease phenylketonuria. Mm. Right? So two things have to happen. A genetic thing has to happen. You got to inherit these broken genes from both your parents because it's a recessive trait. And then you also have to eat foods rich in phenylalanine. And you can cure it by having a diet that has foods that are only low in phenylalanine. So that's another example where versus falls down. But the thing that really gets me exercised is the word nurture, because what nurture means is how your parents raised you or your community raised you or how they failed to or how they neglected you or abused you in unfortunate cases. And of course, our experience in the world is much broader than that. It's much broader than even all social experience. Experience broadly considered means everything that happens from the moment you were conceived in utero to right. your last day. And it includes things like the diseases your mother fought off while you right. were in her womb, to the foods you eat early in life and the temperature that exists early in life, to everything that impacts upon you during that time. So we got to replace nurture, which is very narrow and mostly has to do with your parents and social experience, with experience broadly considered right. encompassing.
And this whole thing is in motion. In other words, the way we nurture is shifting all the time. The culture is shifting, how you raise people. Of course, certain things are, you know, you hold babies when they're young, whatever, or else at dire risk. But you create a picture of something that is evolving that I found really fascinating. And one of the more controversial, but I really thought revealing things was your description, this is later in the book, of intelligence tests on the Irish versus the British. And I just want to slow down and unpack this thing because I thought it was so interesting. The essence of it was, if you look at something like intelligence, which is obviously super controversial to talk about, if you use that old framework of nature versus nurture, which you're not. But if you use this framework, it's unbelievably complicated topic to talk about. And what you're describing is 50 years ago, basically, when they did standard intelligence tests, which may or may not be accurate, so put that aside for a second. But if you did, there was, in the data you cite, a significant difference between these two populations. However, years later, there was not. And it speaks to a huge shift in the economic circumstances, which then relates to how you're raising the kids, et cetera. I thought this was really powerful idea. Can we linger on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, so I think it's important when we talk about human traits to realize that most human traits, whether they're behavioral complicated traits like intelligence or even really basic traits like height, they can have a heritable component. That is, there can be a fraction of them that is explained by heritability. So for example, in the United States, about 85% of the variation in height is determined by the genes you get from your mother and father. That makes it one of the most heritable traits we know. Nonetheless, when you say, well, does that mean that there is one gene for height or a small number of genes for height? No, it doesn't. Actually, there are thousands of genes for height. There are only 19,000 genes in the human genome, but of those, 2,000 to 3,000 of them seem to contribute to the trait of height. So it's highly heritable, but it's also what we call polygenic, meaning that it's determined by the subtle, tiny interactions of variations in many, 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 many different genes. And this is true for something basic like height, but it's also true for every behavioral trait that we have ever been able to measure, from things that the psychologists measure in personality tests like agreeableness and neuroticism and risk-taking and outgoing nature, to things that happen pathologically like schizophrenia, which is an example of a highly heritable neuropsychiatric disease. Mm-hmm. So something can be very heritable, but there is no single gene for it, or even a small number of genes for it. The other thing that I think is really important is that this number of this heritability number only holds for a particular population. So I said 85% of the variability in height can be attributed to genes in the United States. But if you go someplace that's really poor, like rural Bolivia, now only 50% of the variation in height can be attributed to genes. Well, why is that? It's because people can't live up to their genetic potential for height. when they're being malnourished, when they are subject to lots of communicable diseases that they're fighting off, and when they maybe have to use environmental toxins in their workplace, all of these things will tend to stunt their growth and mean that the genetic contribution for height is less heritable in that population than it is in a more affluent culture. And the very same thing is true for intelligence.
So this is huge right here. I mean, this is a really, really big idea, because in a previous part of the book, there's this notion that's sort of in pop psychology now about this intergenerational trauma going through, and somebody had posited that, oh, that maybe there's a genetic change. And you looked at that and you said, hogwash.
Well, yeah. And just to be clear, what I said is right now, there's no evidence for it. I don't have religion on this. In other words, if tomorrow someone showed that there was compelling evidence for transgenerational epigenetic inheritance, that is to say that your grandparents' trauma can be communicated to you via marks in the genome, I'm open to believing that. I'm just saying that right now the evidence for it is not believable.
You cite earlier in the book that this thing where it's, that the height is mostly a genetic characteristics comes from the study of twins in Minnesota, if I got the data source right. But the reason why it wouldn't matter in another place is if everybody can get good food, then the genetic thing dominates. If everybody can't get good food, then it does not, because the people that can eat things that'll make you grow are going to grow much higher. That to me was huge, particularly for somebody who comes from an economic perspective, because the economic shifts in the world have been so substantial over the last 150 years, but also so disparate, some places having them more than others. And so then to relate it back to the study you had of Ireland, that makes a ton of sense, which is that if you have a lot of childhood poverty, it's going to impact the way people grow up. And if you begin to diminish that, you're going to begin to see differences in these, what that mix is of the outcomes. And it's not so much the nurture, it's the experience, as you would say, filtered through the randomness that would then have
That's
a huge
absolutely
change
right. So
in
this particular case, in about 1960, standardized IQ tests were delivered to Irish kids and Irish adults and to a similar population in the UK. And they found that in the UK, the scores were significantly higher than they were among the Irish. And, you know, the Irish in 1960s, there was a lot of poverty. Public health wasn't very good. It was a much poorer country. And yeah. Ireland, to its credit, had an enormous, successful economic and coming with it public health improvement over a couple of generations, such that
Celtic Tiger, they called it. And
that's right. And so then when you go do the same measurements in, say, 2010, 50 years later, right? So two and a half generations later, now the Irish have caught up and they are indistinguishable from the English. Now, this isn't because of any genetic change that's accumulated in those populations in those years. I mean, both Ireland and England have had a small degree numerically of migration, right? There's a few mutations that accumulated, but basically genetically, these are the same populations that they were two and a half generations ago.
Right.
What's changed is the experience. And again, by experience, I don't just mean social experience. I mean everything. I mean nutrition. I mean public health. But also social experience is important. We know that for kids to fulfill their promise for intelligence, they got to have time to play. They have to not like be shoved off to work in the factory when they're young and be curious.
Yeah.
They have to have their parents have enough time to be able to read to them and not be at work constantly. Right? All of these factors come into play. To give an example of how it gets very complicated to think about genetics when you're comparing populations, and this comes up a lot and underlies a lot of racism.
Yes.
So, you know, people will say, oh, all right, well, you know, I think that this group is genetically inferior, and that's why they're IQ test score is lower. Again, assuming that IQ test score even is valid. And let's, as you said, that's a whole other argument.
Right.
So we'll just assume that it has at least some partial validity for the moment. But let me give you this example. So body mass index is a trait that is highly heritable.
Mm-hmm.
Not as quite as heritable as height, but pretty good. Maybe 60, 65% in the United States. If you measure body mass index in the USA and in France, Americans are significantly heavier than French people on average. Well,
Kelsey, please.
This is a trait that's highly heritable, and it's highly heritable in France, and it's highly heritable in the US. So you would say, well, doesn't that mean that the difference between the French and the Americans in the trait of body mass index is a genetic difference? No, it doesn't.
Right.
The reason that Americans are fatter than French people on average isn't because of their significant genetic differences between French people and Americans. It's because Americans eat more calorically dense foods and they exercise less. That's the reason. So just because a trait is heritable doesn't mean that the heritable nature of that trait underlies the difference between populations.
This gets to, you know, one of the most delicate parts of the book, but I thought really quite profound. You talk about this very controversial book that came up. This is on page 243, The Bell Curve. And I remember I was at a debate in college in the 80s, and there was this debate between one African-American student and then one guy who was basically anti-affirmative action. Mm-hmm. And there were hundreds of students there, and they were having this debate about this very, very sensitive topic. The anti-affirmative action guy was like, just have these IQ tests and listen, if you look at the IQs, you get these outcomes, that's what's fair, boom, march ahead. And then the other guy was basically saying, you know, those tests aren't accurate. And neither, I'm not a big fan of the IQ test, but neither argument was satisfying to me. But I was 20 years old and I had no idea how to explore that. This conversation that we're having right now made a ton of sense to me, which is that they could both be accurate and wrong at the same time, because they could be accurate in reflecting, on average, huge income inequalities that have existed and were sort of hardwired into the system, a little bit like what was going on in Ireland. And now, I would say in the last decades, have been hardwired out of the system. So anyways, that's what I was reading. That's the thoughts that go through my mind. But I don't know whether, you know, you're the person who's writing the research, if that seems warm to you.
Well, yeah, I don't know what hardwired out of the system means, actually.
In other words, that used to be that it would be that there was redlining in neighborhoods that you literally couldn't get credit, which then makes gathering income and being able to have a good childhood, you know, have income stability for your children and offer them opportunities. Legally, that used to be almost impossible in the United States for African Americans.
Yeah, and now it still happens. It's just not the law.
It's just not, exactly. It doesn't happen to the same degree that it did.
I mean, I think the important thing that the science can offer, and I have a lecture that I've done actually all around the world now over the last couple of years called The Scientific Case Against Racism. Mm-hmm. You know, when you get down to it, what, you know, the racist argument has been, you said, well, look, around the world, there are these, you know, there are these different environments, and some of them were more challenging than others. Like maybe it was harder to get food and make a society in Europe than it was in Africa,
right,
for example. And so as a result, there wasn't as much selective pressure to be clever in Africa. And so a racist would then say, well, that's why people of African ancestry aren't as bright as people of European ancestry.
Right.
And this argument is horseshit on so many levels, but one of the main ways it's horseshit is that while it's true that there is selection for environments, it's only local selection. In other words, there is no environment of Africa, right?
Right.
Africa has high mountains, it has jungles, has plains, temperate coastline, all these different environments. Same with Europe, it has all these different kinds of environments. So to talk about the environment of a continent,
yep,
like Europe, or the environment of Africa as a driver,
right,
for genetic difference just doesn't hold up.
Right.
Also, when you go look at the kind of traits that people are making claims for, you know, traits like impulsiveness or intelligence. Well, as I mentioned, these traits seem to be, first of all, only partly heritable.
Right.
So, you know, people argue about the heritability of a trait like intelligence, but in the US, something like 40% of the variation in IQ test score seems to be explained by the genes that you inherit. And again, that's using the entire US as a population. If you broke that down, it might be different for different it might be different for poor people, for example, than it is for the middle class or the wealthy, as we discussed. But first of all, that leaves a whole lot of things that aren't heritability. And second of all, in the heritable part, this kind of trait is highly polygenic. It is produced by the sums, subtle variations in hundreds or thousands of different genes. And the racists, like the authors of The Bell Curve, have been saying now for decades, because it's a long time since that book came out, just wait, and pretty soon the genetics will show us exactly how black and brown people are inferior to white people in a trait like intelligence. Well, put up or shut up. It hasn't been shown, right? In other words,
well, it seems like the evidence is going the exact opposite.
The evidence is going the exact opposite. In other words, we now have we can say through a kind of study called the genome-wide association study, we do have candidate genes, a very long list of them, that contribute to the trait of intelligence test score. For example, but each one of these genes contributes an impossibly tiny fractional effect.
Right.
And there is no data that says, all right, if we look people who do poorly on an intelligence test and people who do very well on an intelligence test, we can line these up and say, all right, here's the list of genes that is particularly important for this trait. No. That has not occurred at this moment.
Yeah. One of the precepts for this podcast is related to a Substack is basically that you can learn a lot by following the money. And it's not the only perspective, but it is a perspective. But hearing you tell the story and thinking about Ireland, the shifts in wealth in the United States, certainly suggests to me there's a lot of power from that. You also address in the book sexual preference, which I thought was another interesting example. You said it basically it has this same mix of the hereditary with the experience and the inherent randomness. Can you talk about that a little bit as well?
It's really poorly understood. So if we ask, you know, by doing twin studies and, you know, relative studies, what fraction of sexual orientation appears to be heritable? Mm-hmm. The answer is for cisgendered men, it's about 40%.
What's cisgendered men? Can you say?
Men whose sexual identity corresponds to the sex they were assigned at birth, right? And for cisgendered women, it's about 20%. So first of all, men and women aren't the same. It's not like there's one trait, sexual orientation, that has a heritability. Mm. It's different.
Yep.
So you might ask, well, how does this hold for transgendered folks? Well, the truth is we don't even know because The studies haven't been done. The populations are small. It's a really interesting open question.
Mm-hmm.
But right now, I'm not talking about who you feel yourself to be, which is sexual identity. I'm talking about sexual orientation, meaning who you are attracted to, if anyone. Let's take the female case, 20% of the variation. Well, that's not very much. You know, there is a heritable component there, but it's a pretty small fraction. That leaves 80% for other things. Well, what are the other things? So they are experience broadly considered. And as we mentioned, but didn't really explore earlier, it's also developmental randomness. So what is developmental randomness? It means that our DNA isn't a perfect blueprint down to the finest nut and bolt for building our body. So for example, in our brains, you know, we've got billions of neurons and trillions of connections in our brains, and there is no genetically specified precise wiring diagram. It's rather, it's an approximate wiring diagram. And even in monozygotic twins that have the very same DNA. These are so-called identical twins. I don't like to really use that phrase because they're not really identical. You know, when you look even at birth, two monozygotic twins that have the same DNA and lay right next to each other in the womb for their development, still when they're born, they don't look exactly alike. They don't behave exactly alike. If you do scans of their body, their organs aren't exactly the same shape and size. So they're not really identical. And so where does that non-identicality come from? What it comes from is subtle things having to do with their experience in the womb, but more importantly, it comes from the randomness of development, the fact that given a set of approximate instructions, you never come out with exactly the same outcome. The geneticist Kevin Mitchell has a wonderful expression that I like, which is you can't bake the same cake twice. You know, even if you're following the same recipe, it's going to be a little different every single time. And that little difference is randomness and development. So when we want to ask in a trait like sexual orientation, what accounts for the 80% that's not heritable? Well, you know, we don't entirely know. What we do know is that how your parents raise you seems to have very little to do with it.
Very briefly, you had one statement in another statement of the book that your brain, actually, if you begin to focus on one thing, it can begin to shrink in other areas. And you had the example of the London taxi drivers who need to memorize all these streets, but then they have breakdown something. You just briefly on that. That if you're really focused in one area, develop it, there's actually a diminution of weakening in other areas. Did I get that right?
There is some argument in the field about these results, but you know, it's been known for a long time that if you practice certain things, that the brain area that represents them can get slightly larger. So one of the classic ideas is that London taxi drivers who aren't allowed to use computer navigation and have to memorize like every restaurant in central London. And every location that somebody might want to go to. And that's quite the task to do. And it takes people years to do it. That those people have a part of the brain called the hippocampus that seems to be devoted to this kind of information. A portion of it grows a little bit. Whereas another adjacent portion seems to shrink a little bit. And the claim has been that the cognitive skills that of the part that shrinks are diminished slightly. So there's no free lunch. You're concentrating on one thing, something else gets a little better. We know, for example, that if you play the violin, that the part of your brain that represents the touch and the motor control for your fingering hand becomes larger than the part for your bowing hand, presumably because more skilled movements are required for fingering than for bowing. Similar things can occur when you learn a motor skill like juggling. There seems to be an increase in the volume of brain tissue that represents that skill. But whether this is a universal, that doing this makes you pay in another area, I would say we don't know whether that is an absolutely universal truism for the brain that we have X amount of capacity. And if you use it in one area, you're going to have it diminished in another.
You talk some here about the long-term consequence of the 1918 pandemic. Have you given any thought to this pandemic that we're living through right now? Have you thought about some of the possible ramifications we might see down the line?
Yeah, well, I think there's lots of ramifications. You know, the relation to the 1918 flu that you're referring to is that we know very strongly that the incidence of both schizophrenia and autism increased among children whose mothers were carrying them in the winter of 1918 when the pandemic flu was rampant. And the hypothesis from animal studies is that when pregnant mothers are infected with the flu, their body fights off the flu. This involves a kind of a molecule called a cytokine, and that one particular cytokine crosses through the placenta into the developing fetus and affects brain development that later, when that child is born and grows up, can manifest as an increase in the rate of schizophrenia in the population from about 1% to about 4%, or in the rate of autism in the population, again, from about 1% to about 4%. Now, whether a similar thing will happen with babies who were carried during the COVID pandemic, is an open question. It could be, maybe, maybe not. I mean, it may be that the cytokines that are produced in response to COVID infection are different and that these don't affect brain development in this way, or maybe they do, or maybe they will affect brain development in a way that is problematic, but different than what happened in the influenza pandemic of 1918. So there are certainly all those things that we're only going to know when this population ages up in, you know, 20 years or so. But of course, there are also all the effects of isolation, social isolation during the pandemic. And those are also interesting and important.
The podcast is Things I Didn't Learn in School. What, if you look back on your career, where you are now, and all of this research, if you sort of were to distill for more of a broader audience, the biggest things that you've learned through this journey that you didn't learn in school, any thoughts you'd share with listeners?
Yeah, I would say maybe the most important thing that I've learned and the field of neuroscience and has learned in general is that it's very easy for us to imagine that in terms of our mental lives, that there is there's the realm of biology with drugs and neurotransmitters and genes and chemicals and neuroanatomy and brain scanners, and that there is another realm involved with things like, you know, disappointment and love and faith and feelings and friendship. And what I would say is that this is a false dichotomy. These things interact. We know that social experience and our experience in the world, all our interactions with humans, that they change our brains. Mm-hmm. When talking cure psychotherapy works, and it often does work, it doesn't work in a completely separate airy-fairy realm.
Right.
It works ultimately because it changes the biology of your brain. Right?
Right.
And likewise, the biology of your brain isn't this immutable, genetically determined, hardwired computer that forges on depending on what you do, you know, independent of what you do. It is this device that is built to be social, built to be plastic, built to be changed by all the experiences that impinge upon us, including social experience. So when you have your heart broken in love, when your feelings are hurt, this co-opts the same circuitry in your brain that happens when you stub your toe. Hurt isn't a metaphor for what happens to us emotionally. It is literally overlaps with what happens when we stub our toe.
Yeah.
What I would say is that there is a constant interplay, you know, between our experience and our biology. And it is that which makes our human experience and which makes our lives rich and wonderful.
Yeah, that's very beautifully said. That's one of the things I took away from reading this book and other writing of yours, listening to talks, is it's basically just a different language, a different perspective, a biological, neurological perspective on describing the same type of events and experiences people are feeling in other realms that they're approaching to. And you even talked about that. I think of one of your talks, you said you describe somebody as tactless, meaning somebody who has poor social skills, but tact is touch, and touch is connection, and connection is all the things that are going on in your mind when it gets lit up. And so it's sort of like a continuation through from one realm to another, different language.
That's right. I mean, it really comes up in the sense of touch, and it comes up with the ideas of warmth. The idea that someone who's warm is someone who's not a threat, who is an ally, is something that's broadly cross-cultural, and there is a deeply biological root for that. The reason that we say we had a rough day, again, that's a tactile thing. Oh, yes. It was a smooth experience when everything went well.
Yeah.
That person is tactless, meaning that they are socially inept. The reason that these are all touch metaphors speaks to the fact that touch is an inherently social sense.
Yes, you don't have to, but all the guests we have here, I said, you want to ask me anything.
Well, I'll ask you one question. So you've interviewed a lot of people from a lot of different walks of life. What was the most surprising thing that you ever heard from a guest on this podcast?
There's been so many of them But I think that one thing that somebody said that actually I think relates to you. Well, I had FBI director, former director Jim Comey on the podcast, and he's obviously made a career out of investigating people. That's what they do. And I asked him for his biggest life lesson. And he said, honest people are very rare if we include honesty in the sense of not only telling the truth, but being self-aware about their own foibles. It's not exactly his words, but it's paraphrasing. But what you're saying actually relates to that, because to some degree, we're hardwired to have those blind spots in terms of just the limitations of our brain, but maybe also the willingness to continue plodding on, even in circumstances like the one you're in right now.
Indeed.
I guess sometimes there can be miracles, and we'll certainly be hoping for one.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you.
And very, very grateful for you taking the time.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to today's episode. We're genuinely touched by all the support. If you want to see more of this type of content, sign up to my Substack and become a paid subscriber. That helps support the team. You could also submit a review to Apple Podcasts, which draws other listeners to this. If you have any questions, you can email me, paul@paulpodolsky.com, and follow me on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn. Thanks so much.
Today's podcast was produced and edited by Dave Manahan.